Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 365 of the Roguecast, recorded March 8th, 2022, The Secret History of Clown Comics.
All right, well, we made it 2 months before we had to take a break.
Yes, it was sad to have to skip last week. Yeah. But I feel like we still have momentum going.
I agree. Well, so what happened is the comics came super late last week. For the first time since switching over the new distributors, we didn't get Marvel till like late Tuesday night. And then Diamond came a little late. And so, yeah, we were just sort of running a little late.
Yeah. Don't hate us. Well, hate Nick. Because he probably had something to do with it.
That's okay. Yeah, I feed on your hate.
Oh, see? He's like a Sith Lord.
So, yeah, we're back.
Unleash your anger.
It also is kind of over because last week was a huge week, and this week is also kind of a huge week.
We're going to cover a little bit of stuff from last week, I think. A
lot of comics to talk about.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about a lot of comics. But before we get to that, I want to mention that we got in also this week the Princess Bride action figures.
Yep. Yes. You can finally recreate the battle between Inigo Montoya and Dread Pirate Roberts, aka Wesley,
while Buttercup looks on.
Right, and she's like throwing down bets.
Yeah. Or you can mix and match. I think they're McFarlane figures, so you can have Wesley fight Batman.
Yeah.
You can have Montoya fight Stormtrooper.
And you can have Buttercup date Harley Quinn.
Yes. All things that can happen. We got Bananagrams, which is a long-time game that finally started coming in from our distributor. You guys know this game?
I know the Banana Phone song from the early days of the internet.
Thank you for that, though.
I know of its existence. I know it comes in a banana-shaped packaging.
It comes in a
I have not played it.
It comes in a zippered banana case.
Uh-huh.
Are we allowed
to sell that? That's illegal, right?
It comes with these tiles, like scrabbly tiles, and I guess basically you get, like, letters, and you have to make your own crossword, but it's, like, a real-time thing.
Oh.
So, like, you make a little crossword of all these intersecting words out of letters you get. All the people are trying to do the same.
Oh, that's kind of fun.
It looks cool. I kind of want to try it.
I like word games, and that sounds fun.
I don't know why it's Bananagrams. I don't know if there's bananas involved.
It's
somehow
fun to say.
I guess.
It comes in a zippered banana.
Oh. Anagrams.
Oh,
Bananagrams.
I got it.
Yeah.
I'm down with it.
We also got the regular version, and we got
a baby version.
Baby version.
I don't know what the baby version comes with. Like, it's just like two letters.
Goo goo ga ga.
Goo and ga ga.
Should have been in a baby banana.
Yes. We also got Familiar Tales, which is a new one from Plat Hat, the guys who do Dead of Winter.
Yep.
And what's their big storybook one? That I'm blanking on.
Not Mice and Mystics.
But Mice and Mystics is similar type of thing.
Yeah.
It is stuffed fables.
Stuffed fables. That's right.
One of these where basically you the little booklet is the map, and this is a sort of a fairy tale kind of thing. Supposed looks like fun.
It does.
Echoes the Microchip. This is a new game for the people who do like the adventure games and the escape games.
Yeah.
But this one is all audio stuff. So it's like audio clues and stuff.
Oh, does that mean it's app driven?
I think it must be, but most of those are.
Or does it come with an old-time cassette tape?
It comes with a wax cylinder gramophone.
Oh, neat.
I thought it came with an MP, like a MP3.
I mean, it could.
Do that. Those are cheap.
You can have a little USB thing.
Yep.
In any case, audio cues sound fun.
It comes with a little halfling that's packed in the box that speaks speaks spoken word games to you.
Please feed me and I'll run the game for you.
Feed me and I'll play the game with you.
I need a little food first. I've been in the box for 3 weeks.
No, game first, food later.
Yes, sir.
We got the newest installment of Marvel Villainous, which is Mischief and Malice. This is an expansion, but it's also a standalone. This is one where you play the villains and you're trying to achieve their goals. This one has MODOK, Loki, and Madame Mask.
Interesting. I'd like to see Madame Mask get her due.
Yeah.
Can you can't merge this with the Disney game, right? I couldn't have like Hades and Captain Hook fighting to defeat MODOK, could I?
I don't think it's like an unmatched kind of thing.
Yeah, it's not that kind of thing. It is sort of like
I think it's every villain for themselves in the game,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but you throw cards at your opponents and that kind of thing to stop them on their goals for world domination.
Since I haven't heard it, I assume you can't mix and match the Marvel and the regular Disney one, right?
I don't know.
Dave, no crossovers. No crossovers.
I don't know if you can't. And I feel like someone must have done the work to make it work. Because it's the same gameplay.
Yep. I want to see it.
We got a game called First Empires. It looks like a roll and write, I think. Kind of you're building your empire. I think it goes at like six players. Looks pretty cool. We got a game called Rest in Peace that is a puzzle Tetris-y type thing where I feel like it's a graveyard thing.
Ooh.
I had it described to me. It sounded really cool.
Sounds delightful.
We got the Pathfinder Complete Chronicles from Beatles and Grimm. This is the guys who do sort of the upscale books and stuff for D&D.
Right. Pathfinder.
These are like big hardcovers that are like there's foil lettering and all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
And what it is basically if you have a character you just like deeply love.
Yep.
It has a character sheet, all the rules you need for your character, like all like if you get the wizard one, it's got all the spells and that kind of thing pulled out of the main book and the advanced rules. So you have like all the rules on hand. A journal, a character sheet, all that kind of stuff, and like this big hardcover. It is super fancy and cool.
That's pretty neat. One of those very good gift items, something for the birthday or anniversary or whatever of your GM, players, et cetera.
There's a wizard, rogue, cleric, fighter, and weirdly druid.
That's not weird.
It's weird.
Don't hate on the horn crown wearing beeples.
I'm just saying, wizard, rogue, cleric, fighter, those are the four main classes, and then you throw in druid.
Druids have been around a long time too, Randy.
I guess.
Longer than D&D, okay? They were living in peat bogs.
Wait, are we still talking about D&D druids? Or?
No, the ancient druids of my circle. Who you have wronged. Now we will revenge ourselves upon you, Randy Lander.
Oh no, this is how I wind up in a midsummer type thing.
And then I draw my sickle and behead Randy.
Yes.
And shove him off a cliff.
Things escalated, yeah. Wee, midsummer. midsummer break, y'all!
It's gonna go well.
We also got those Magic the Gathering miniatures.
Yeah,
both
yeah.
Both some new unpainted and some painted ones.
Yep. And in the process of putting those out, we rearranged a little bit in a way that I think will make it more clear. The dragon minis have been fixed up. All the pre-painted minis are in a nice little stripe together.
Yep.
Anyway, yeah, it looks cool. And obviously all those magic ones have the same quality that WizKid's been doing for years now.
And they're planeswalkers, so it's like a Johnny and some of those.
Right, it's the big guys, the heroes.
I like to just say there's miniatures everywhere.
I mean, it's true.
And yep. I think we're even getting another wave this week.
That seems likely. Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken,
we're always making room for it. We get many compliments on our mini selection, and
therefore we have to give it its best face all the time.
Yeah. We also have a restock on Machikoro 2.
Okay.
Which is the dice rolling game of building a Japanese city.
Yep.
This is the new version of that, and it's been out for a few months, and then we just got that back in. So, all right. That is store news. Let's talk pop culture news, and let's start with trailers. We just watched the trailer for Bullet Train.
Yep.
Bullet Train the movie, I think is what it's called. As opposed to Bullet Train the Train.
Sort of a comedic suspense spy-ish or crime-ish kind of movie.
Yeah. It's directed by David Leitch, who did Deadpool 2, and I was involved in John Wick and things like that.
I mean, if you told me Deadpool and John Wick, that'd make sense with this trailer.
That tracks.
But honestly, I think this is the first time Brad Pitt's been starred in a movie in quite a while.
He's having a good summer, though. He's in this, and then he's also in that movie with that's romance, the modern day Romancing the Stone thing.
Oh yeah, with Sandra Bullock.
He's getting to be like his kind of typical, his classic sex symbol sort of self in that. In this, he looks kind of like doofus with a fisherman cap on.
Yeah, but he's a hitman.
Yeah,
hitman who's trying to turn a new leaf by no longer killing anybody.
Y'all know I love hitman movies, you can probably guess how excited I am for this. Which is to say, I'll let y'all see it and enjoy it.
Did you groan while you saw this in the movie theater
a little bit? I might have groaned inwardly.
This looks like pretty much up my alley kind of stuff. I like quirky crime drama or quirky crime comedy stuff.
Well, I love Brad Pitt, so
it's a good trailer. It's scored to a Japanese version of Staying Alive.
Yep.
It's got a lot of good people in it.
It's got a Guy Ritchie type vibe.
Yeah. I dug it. Then we saw a trailer for a show coming to Netflix or a show coming to Prime called The Outlaws.
Yes.
This seems to be Stephen Merchant, a.k.a. Half of The Office, the British Office. Big, tall, gangly guy.
Yep. It's a bunch of people doing, community service. Smallish crimes?
Yeah, smallish crimes. They're working
financial on malfeasance and things like that.
They're trying to clean up a community center, and then a bag of money falls, and they decide what to do with it, but it belongs to criminals.
And is it a collection of wacky types, sort of maybe headlined by old man Christopher Walken.
Christopher Walken, yeah.
Really chewing it up and having a lot of good, like, the source of some of the funniest moments in it. But there's a bunch of different pairings. There's a right-wing dude, left-wing chick, a young couple that's probably going to fall in love.
Yep.
Good girl.
Yeah.
Bad guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It looks actually very fun. Like a, you know, that's a very stock premise. But, you know, what it reminded me of is a little bit like Midnight Run, one of our favorite unsung movies of the 80s, has a very stock premise. A bounty hunter trying to drag a guy across country who doesn't want to go while evading other, you know, like, would-be hitmen and bounty hunters. It's actually, that's not a great premise.
No.
As executed, it's fantastic. This looks like something that, if it's as good as the trailer is, will be all in the execution.
I feel the same way. The premise didn't do anything for me, but the trailer's great.
Yeah.
So.
It felt like it had like an Edgar Wright kind of vibe to
it.
Yeah,
I think so.
And then there's a trailer for Apollo 10 and a Half on Netflix. This is a Richard Linklater movie using the rotoscoping technology of like
Scanner Darkly.
Yep.
And it looks like a sort of a fun and wistful remembrance of his childhood in the 60s, growing up kind of under the shadow of the space program, but with the kind of a fantasy element of a kid who is taken in by NASA to actually go to the moon, I believe, and because they accidentally made the ship a little too small.
They built the moon too small by accident. I love the opening. It's the two guys, Zachary Levi, and I don't know who the other agent is.
He sounded like Rob Lowe, but I know it's not Rob Lowe.
And he's like, they're talking to him, and the kid's like, you birthed too small, and he's like, look, you good at math? Yeah. You get 100 on every test? No. Well, shut up then.
So the kid is, like, secretly training to go on to moon mission. There's little glimpses of also just, like, 60s life that'll kind of recall the same way he did, you know, his 70s teen years in, what was the movie? Dazed and Confused.
Dazed and Confused,
But this, you know, obviously has, like, this much, like, kind of more of an air of innocence. A little bit of, the original Wonder Years.
Yeah, I was going to say Wonder Years bit. Yeah.
But with again, this kind of fun fantasy side thing about going on an actual space mission, which it looks like actually happens, unless it's some kind of weird dream sequence where he's imagining that to avoid listening to his parents fight. I don't know.
It could be. We don't know. But it looks fun.
But, yeah, he is good at, like, capturing those moments, that kind of... either childhood stuff or both the pain and happiness of that kind of stuff.
Nick sent this one to the group chat that we have for topics with the comment, I guess they'll put everything on streaming. Anthony Mackie's Twisted Metal series is headed to Peacock.
Oh, right. I remember playing Twisted Metal on
PlayStation.
That was a PlayStation 1. Yeah, it was PlayStation 1.
It was one of their early kind of standout games. It was like... Essentially, for those gamers out there, it was Car Wars, but with kind of like a specifically a lot of like in-your-face kind of like a style to it. There's 90s extreme mapped onto Car Wars.
I know there was an evil clown who drove an ice cream truck.
That was the big one.
Is that who Anthony Mackie is going to play?
I have no idea.
Honestly,
he was the main character of the...
A kind of anarchic, Car Wars-ish, you know, apocalyptic thing, but with like sort of pop sensibilities, you know, that Guy Ritchie sensibility from the Bullet Train and stuff like that. Could be fun. I mean, it's weird to adapt a video game that really hasn't been thought of, I think, much in 30 years.
Yeah.
But,
Beloved.
Have there been new... I mean, Twisted Metal was a breakout game on the PS1 back then.
There were several Twisted Metals, weren't there?
I think at least a second one, but, like, have they recreated it recently? Is there, like, does the PS5 have a Twisted Metal, maybe?
I have no idea.
I just wonder what would land that one somehow as a property that's happening. You know, stuff gets in development hell.
Yeah.
I like to imagine there was a movie, like, in 1995 they were working on this, and it just finally got out of development hell.
The last Twisted Metal was a PS3 game in 2012.
Ways back.
It might have been a remastered version.
Weird. It's weird. I don't know what to say. I don't particularly want to see it. It could sort of be kind of fun, anarchic fun, because like generally when you get like post-apocalyptic stuff, you get sort of very self-serious. It's either gloomy dystopias like Hunger Games or kind of gritty dystopias like Mad Max. But where's the fun dystopias? Where's the fun post-apocalypse? There's not a whole lot of those. The closest I can think of was that movie. Was it Doomsday?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was like the chaotic smashings of every kind of genre you can think of.
Just stupid.
There is a new Twisted Metal game in development for the PS5.
Okay. Okay, that makes sense.
So I'm just like, are they just going through all these video games? And I mean, nothing's sticking. Nothing's working.
Well, The Witcher, which I know that's a book series too, but it boomed because of the game series, right?
Right.
So The Witcher
comes out soon, right?
It's this week, I believe.
Before I know, and by the way, Uncharted is doing pretty decent, and people are even saying, like, basically I hear a lot of, it was solid, not as bad as I thought, or expected. So I actually might, at some point, watch the Uncharted movie.
Yeah, plus, I mean, I'll watch it.
Remember my Dig Dug animated series I've been pitching you guys.
I am in full support of this. I think the Steven Universe style of animation that was a little overused for a while would fit it. It's time for it.
I'm just saying, why don't they make movies or shows out of things like Star Fox or Metroid or...
There's a weird... You know what's weird is part of it, like, a lot of those Nintendo games deliberately have very minimal backstory and they just kind of focus on, like, fun gameplay stuff.
Yeah.
So Mario doesn't have, like, a lot of depth.
But
Zelda, even those, like, they have story, but, like, Link himself is not a...
But any more story than Twisted Metal? I mean...
Twisted Metal is a deep lore.
Yeah.
Actually, they may be doing that on the new one because that's a thing these days. You get a clown truck and you find out the secret history of clown truck.
they're doing a Resident Evil TV show and it's like the 17th outing for a Resident Evil.
Yeah,
and I'm just like,
I'm weary of Resident Evil at this point.
Yeah,
I mean, I
think that's you should be.
You will be. What were we even talking about?
You're talking about Twisted Metal and Anthony Mackie.
Okay,
Rampage
yeah.
and Mortal Kombat.
Sure,
those are the only video games that
I feel like it's not necessarily a career-advancing pick, Anthony Mackie,
right.
But, yep. You know, you do you.
Yeah, I'm wondering if Anthony Mackie's not getting offered good roles or something, because...
Maybe.
That dude was in Winter Soldier. He's going to be Captain America, but, like, he did that, like, sci-fi movie for Netflix where he was okay in, and then he's doing
this.
Have we
checked his Instagram? Maybe he is, like, the biggest Twisted Metal fan in all the land.
He could be. I don't know. Maybe
he might have just played
the
hell out of that in the 90s.
He's like, I was 10 years old, and I loved that game.
He's like, I will play the clown before
I
die. I
can't think of any of the other cars other than the stupid ice cream truck.
Well, that was sort of the main one, but yeah.
I mean, there had to have been others, right? I mean,
no, it was only that
car.
No,
I didn't play it.
There's 100 ice cream trucks.
Just clown ice cream trucks all in a giant arena of clowns.
Oh, there was the weird giant tires with the guy, like, in between them.
Is that about General Grievous' vehicle?
I mean, that's close.
And the big wheel.
There's a character named Preacher and Dollface.
Nobody remembers any of those people.
No.
But, again, could be fun in a goofy movie.
Listeners should understand that Nick's looking at his phone.
I am.
But we don't know that he actually has it turned on. He's been making things up, and David and I would be not.
He's
yeah,
like,
that sounds right.
There's the fisherman. There's Johnny Mudpie. There's old tinfoil hat. And
it looks like Cracker Jack.
Yes.
Well, I'm
Bubbles.
I mean, the ice cream truck driver's name is Sweet Tooth, so it's really not going like super
monkey
far
meat.
Field.
all right, let's move Twisted Metal to our past.
All right, Kevin Smith, speaking of the past, Kevin Smith did comics for a long time. I think Oni Press launched with Kevin Smith comics. You remember this?
God, I forgot that.
It's like 20 years ago, or whatever. So they one of their big launches was they had a Clerks comic.
Yeah. Did they do? Later, they did a Blunt Man and Chronic.
And a Blunt Man and Chronic graphic novel with Michael Avon Oeming of Powers fame.
Yep,
one of his early things. Well, Kevin Smith is doing full circle. He's coming to do a Dark Horse Comics line called Secret Stash Press. It's going to be a line inside. So it's kind of like one of their... It's a line at Dark Horse. Not like they have these lines that
little subline.
Karen Berger had there. Has
yeah,
one line.
Probably going to be like four or five books.
So it's going to be an 8-issue series called Masquerade about a budding vigilante. I'm going to guess he smokes pot. Probably pees himself. and then he's going to do an anthology called Quick Stops... set in the Viewisk universe that's going to have Clerks, Small Rats. So kind of the thing... What I think is interesting is, early on, like, this was early Jim Mahfood art.
Yep.
And it was, as I recall, kind of funny stuff. And it's been out of print forever.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping the Dark Horse will, like, put that stuff back into print, because I think it's actually pretty good.
Uh-huh.
And it's early work by good creators. I don't know that I'm any particular interest in sending anything Kevin Smith's doing now.
Yeah.
But some of his fans do.
He did a better than, like, he produced the Masters of the Universe series. And he, that didn't feel, it wasn't filled with stoner references. It had some pretty good beats in it.
He did get a Fisto joke in there, but everybody gets one.
Everybody gets one. But that was a rare exception in there. Otherwise, it was very serious and had great score from Bear McCreary, from Battlestar Galactica and all that stuff. In other words... Although they are doing it a view askew comic, I wouldn't necessarily assume that everything is going to be like that. He may just be trying to do the I'm going to do the editorial stewardship sort of thing. Sure.
He's going to write, draw, letter, and color every issue.
I think he should have take transcripts of his podcast, Fat Man on Batman, and turn them into comics, which are just a bunch of people talking to each other in an interview room.
Yeah.
Get all of Bendis's collaborators.
Yes.
They're used to doing that. Who's the guy who works with him the most?
Avin Oeming?
Maleev. Yeah, Maleev can draw Kevin Smith and whoever the guest is just talking to each other endlessly. By the way, that is my favorite Kevin Smith project of like the last 20 years, probably, is those that his interview stuff on Fat Man on Batman is very listenable to.
Yeah,
you know, he talks
good.
To somebody for 2 hours, and he got the best of the best Batman creators, Neil Adams, and like a million other giant names, and they were, you know, he's solid interviewer. It's just one of those things that goes on long enough, some decent questions get out there.
Yeah. You know, if we were doing G.I. Joe Military Operational Specialties,
yes,
I believe, Dave, you'd be the podcasts guy, I'm the TV guy, and Nick is the movie guy.
I guess. I'm not really a very good podcast guy.
You're more the podcast guy than me or Nick, I think.
I don't think so. But sure, I'll take it.
I think you're the podcast guy. that is your military operational specialty.
Military specialty is Shakespeare, Randy.
Oh, right.
Obviously.
Jason Momoa has been confirmed to be playing the villain in Fast and Furious 10. Which, of course, he is. I mean... Yeah, you need a meathead for your meathead movies.
Can't have The Rock. You'll get Jason Momoa. He's like the poor man's Rock.
Whatever. Dave, I believe you've noped out of Fast and Furious.
I think so. I think I just hit my limits of silliness in that last one. And it wasn't even...
There's only two more to go.
Just
ride or die, Dave.
Dave, you dragged me into this world. You got to ride or die with us. Otherwise... We're going to have a funeral for your very much alive self.
Do you know how many times I have done that to people? I remember when I kind of got everybody on Supernatural back in the day.
Yeah, then you quit.
And then I was like, I watched a season, I'm like, that's about it for me.
I watched 5 seasons, you son of a bitch.
Yep. Well, get ready to finish out the Fast and Furious series for me.
You know, Nick and I are going to go, and we're going to be like, yeah, this is our friend. We went to his name's Dave. Well, there's Dave. He's right over there. No, we named this character after him.
That's a deep cut reference for people who may not know what you're talking about.
I feel like that's got to be a well known joke. That basically Brian, the actor died, but the character did not.
Yes,
but they kind of talk about him in the movie as if
he's dead.
As if he's dead, even though they made it very clear that he's just gone off to live a life. Like that was how the send off that they gave him.
They name a baby after him at one point.
Yeah. They're like, this is for you, bro. We'll never forget you. I'll call you in an hour. Anyway, so here's what's going to happen is whenever the trailer comes out, that will be the deciding thing. If they manage to win me over the trailer, I will go ahead and watch another movie. but I did feel my soul die a little bit in the last one.
Did you not have fun in Fast and Furious 9? It was fun. It's fun.
There were magnets.
There were magnets. There was space.
What was the magnets? Oh, right. Yeah.
John Cena was fun.
Well, they are going to get every meathead actor that gets John Cena.
They're going to hit a critical threshold and form a super meathead. A gestalt giant made up of just pure veiny biceps and Jason Momoa's hair.
God.
Sorry for that picture.
Sleep tight, everybody.
That's right. When it moves around, it's just like a big hefty bag full of meat sloshing.
And Vin Diesel is the head, and he talks incessantly about his elf.
Yeah, say your prayers, or the giant meat man will come to you in your dreams.
Slosh, slosh, slosh. Right. Does Vin Diesel have an elf? What are you talking about?
He's talking about his
RPG character.
Oh, right. I was like, what is
he an elf?
Isn't he like...
I think he's one of those like...
I thought he was a half elf.
Ranger, fighter, you know, warrior of the wasteland kind of guy.
I have to look up because I feel like I thought he was an elf.
It'd be funny, but I don't think so.
This is exciting news. Chip Zdarsky has been announced as the new writer for Batman.
Yeah.
This is super cool.
He's been cutting his teeth on Daredevil for a couple years now, 2-3 years, and has through like image books like New Burn and stuff like that shown he can do a crime writing.
Mm-hmm.
So and he's also like done some like what has he done else is like classic superhero stuff. He also did this Spider-Man Life, what's the...
Life Story.
Life Story,
Life
one.
Story, yep.
I think that's a big win for DC.
Yeah, I do too.
He's already done, like, he did a good Red Hood story in Batman Urban Legends.
He's doing that, The Knight, which is the origin, like, Batman training story. The pitch he had sounded interesting. I forget the exact details, but it is sort of a, like, it sounds like a good pitch. And Jorge Jimenez is doing the art still. Jorge Jimenez was on James Tynion's, and it's
okay.
Really good.
Yeah, that's good art.
So I'm excited for this. I think that starts in May, June, somewhere there on there.
That sounds right. Yeah. Anyway, I'm looking forward to that. DC's, like, they've really, the bat line has been strong lately.
Yeah, for sure. All right, that does it for us for news. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk about comics for the week.
Hell yeah.
We're talking comics the week of March 2nd and March 9th.
Okay.
So
you could have just said any numbers. I don't keep track
March
of dates anymore.
March 14th and and Jovlov.
Oh, right. Those were good books.
Let's start with this week's stuff. Maybe the most notable is that Marvel is relaunching Punisher.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there are some change-ups going on.
By way of
Punisher's
Jason
world.
Aaron, Jesus says.
Yep. Very pretty art.
Jason Aaron, who, by the way, in the last few years, like his biggest thing has for sure been Thor, right?
Yep.
That was, you know, he presided over not just the time when the Jane Foster was Thor, but also lots of Thor versus the God Butcher. That was, like, his first story.
Yep.
And a very popular, very metal run on Thor.
So it's kind of interesting. The opening couple of pages of Punisher is actually drawn by Paul Azaceta.
Oh, that's
it's
that
a it's a
sense.
Really harrowing and sequence.
It is a retelling of his
when his family got shot down in the park, and it's kind of like almost like a point of view of him like fading in and out of consciousness as the first responders get there and assess the situation.
Yep.
And then I love the collage.
Yeah, there's a 2-page spread of Frank Castle is the Punisher, and it's like it's got a ton of art from different. I see Zek in there. I see. Gorin Parlov.
I saw Wilche Portacio.
Jim Lee. Majority of the basically everybody who's ever drawn the Punisher.
Yep.
They do a collage of a bunch of the different artists, and it is pretty cool looking.
By the way, the thing with the kind of the very medical approach to like all the injuries and stuff in the park, it reminded me one of the earliest comics that kind of made a mark on me as far as like scarring me a little was Randy. Do you remember this issue of New Mutants? It was the Demon Bear storyline. When Danny gets badly injured by the Demon Bear at the end of like one of the issues, and the next issue starts with her in the hospital, and they're like, she's being like on a gurney or whatever, and they're like collapsed lung, broken ribs. They're like talking about all these like things that you normally don't get in superhero comics, and it's kind of that kind of medical assessment of these injuries is pretty harrowing.
Yeah, agreed.
And then things get weirder.
Yeah, there's this in Greece. There's this organization. That is like they're holy weapons mongers. They like they sell weapons in the name of their holy general they say bless the war. They're talking about like this crazy like Shi'ar sniper rifles with drone based targeting services.
Yeah, they'll kind of weaponize any sort of tech that's out there in the Marvel universe, like unstable molecules and stuff like that.
And then they get attacked by some guy wielding a sword, and it turns out, spoilers, it's Frank Castle.
Yeah, and you're like, what's even going on with that? I think it's baked into the premise here that there is a connection being forged, for reasons you'll want to read it for, between the Punisher and the ninja organization, The Hand.
Yep.
He has fought before. That's, you know, people mostly know from Daredevil. They resurrected Elektra. They have been a thorn in Daredevil's side forever. But now Punisher has a sort of weird alliance sort of thing with them.
Yeah, he has a new costume, the new logo. He's got he's using swords instead of guns.
Yep.
And it's all in service to a sort of last page reveal that I thought was interesting.
Yeah. I feel like Jason Aaron did a pretty good job on that first issue.
Yeah. It's a good first issue. I think we're varying stripes of Punisher fan. Nick goes Punisher fan way back.
It's true.
I have liked a fair amount of Punisher stuff.
I was a big Punisher fan as a kid when there were not many Punisher stories. So
yeah.
I actually had like his earliest appearances. I had bought them before he got his miniseries. So I like to think I'm an OG Punisher fan.
Ah.
This was before any of the miniseries had even happened, before he ever got his own title. But I did, like, also read those. A friend of mine bought them, I think, as a kid, and I read his copies over and over and over again. But by the time the 90s came around and Punisher was in, like, two titles, I was done with him. And then I've been varying stripes of, I like him as a presence in the Marvel Universe, okay, but also have been kind of increasingly, I'm going to say, uneasy with him over the years.
Yeah, I get that.
For a lot of ways, I mean, he works better in, like, a Max title where he's not super connected to the Marvel Universe.
That's true.
However,
I sort of agree and sort of don't. I kind of like him when he's on the periphery. Like, if he were to show up every once in a while as a guest star in Spider-Man or any other given character's comic on occasion, I think that'd be okay. I like him more as like an antagonist slash uneasy alliance thing.
Yeah, well, Brubaker used him really well when he got Daredevil out of jail.
That was fantastic. A great use of his history with Daredevil, too.
And Zdarsky's had him show up in Daredevil as well. I guess what I'm saying is that I feel like Jason Aaron is kind of bridging the gap a little bit between, because there are some fantastical ideas in here.
Right. The hand themselves are like sort of, they always combine a certain degree of mysticism. And then these bad guys at the beginning are definitely a superhero threat, but they are arms dealers.
Yeah. But this is a violent book. This is, there are some kind of knockdown drag out fights. It gives you what you want from both kind of avenues.
Yeah,
of Punisher.
Yeah. Arguably Punisher is one of those that's such a simple concept that you're like, oh, should you ever change anything? But I'm like, sometimes I think it's nice to see a new direction of that. Like, oh, you might actually be surprised by something you see in Punisher. Imagine that.
Yeah. Yep. Couple alternate world books this week. Captain Carter, Jamie McKelvey, switched over from art to writing, and is telling the story of Peggy Carter as Super Soldier.
Yep.
This is not in the What If continuity. It does seem to be slightly tweaked.
Does she wear the same costume as the What If?
Jamie McKelvey designed a new costume for her.
Oh, that's right, because he's an artist first.
Which is a solid looking costume. I like it. But she's in the modern day. She is back to working for like MI5 or something.
I like who her handler is. I thought that was a fun nod.
Is that something we don't want to say?
Yeah, I think it's better left.
Yeah. So if you like that character, she's getting a miniseries.
Yep.
Spider-Gwen, who has always been an alternate world character and had kind of moves around dimensions pretty easily, gets a series called Gwenverse, where we're going to see Spider-Gwen as various other characters. She's fighting a sort of multidimensional threat. And the first person she runs into is Thor Gwen. And, it's going to be kind of like what they're doing with the What If Miles Morales thing.
Nice.
Which I guess we should mention that's last week's, but... What If Miles Morales is a 5-issue miniseries that starts off with a What If where Miles Morales is Captain America. And I actually quite like that. I don't know if you guys read it, but he's got a partner who's a female Falcon who is maybe like his girlfriend... They use the Prowler as sort of a mercenary type. They do a different version of Red Skull, and then they're tying in different. There's like an alternate reality thing, so that you're going to see Miles as what if he was Wolverine, what if he was the Hulk. It sounds kind of doofy, but I actually kind of like the first issue quite a bit, and I'm curious to see how they go on from there. There's a Marvel Voices one shots every month. This month it is Women of Marvel to tie in with International Women's Month. Gail Simone writes an introduction about sort of like the period when she went to Marvel and became like one of the only women writers in comics.
Yeah. Finish your thought.
How Marvel sort of treated her well that way. Yeah.
I saw there was an interview with the longtime editor Bobby Chase in there. And I was just skimming through that, and it was interesting. They talked about like her kind of pushing back against some establishment norms back in the day by touching on things like when Peter David did that story in Hulk where who was like his old his buddy when he was the kid who got AIDS when he had grown up, Jim Rhodes. And she was the editor over that, and she talks about that and some other stuff and how the editorial, like, I think whoever was PR for Marvel was like, we don't want to be in the news. And I just thought it was interesting to see them kind of talk openly about that sort of stuff at the time, where you had to, like, any story that had, like, sort of LGBT themes of any sorts were, like, something that editorial would be like, I don't know about that. So she was very groundbreaking.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, it's got anthology.
And then a bunch of anthology stories
by all female creators by with all female characters. I see several Black Cat, I see Silver Sable, Black Widow. So worth a look.
I think the Black Cat one is a framing story.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's a new Star Wars book this week, Han Solo and Chewbacca, written by Mark Guggenheim. It is during the period when Han was working for Jabba, and he winds up on a heist with Greedo.
Thought it was a fun idea.
It's fun. It's
it felt very kind of Solo.
Yeah, they're definitely nodding to the Solo movie, I think. Dave, I saw Little Monsters, which is the new Jeff Lemire, Dustin Nguyen.
Yeah, we've had people asking about the poster for it up on our window recently. It is a when I made the sign for it, I found out what it was about just yesterday. That it is about a sort of an apocalyptic Earth where it seems like only kids survive, and we will kind of over the course of things maybe determine these kids might be vampires, frozen in their youth and kind of eternally living out like kind of kids' games, even though they're sort of bored of them. I think you said reunited with Dustin Nguyen, who did the art on Descender. With him. Super good artist. He's kind of doing a inky black and white look in this one, not his like sort of full painted look. But it's a good little opener. It's one of those ones that gives the characters kind of room to breathe, and you kind of see the kids as a group in it. I feel like they're like it actually does feel like Peter Pan's Lost Boys, which. Given that the actual movie Lost Boys did start out being a literal reference to Peter Pan, before it went through many, many, many changes and that got dropped, all but the title.
I'm glad he went in this direction and not in the other direction where he could have been with Little Monsters, which had been a sequel to the Fred Savage and Howie Mandel movie.
you don't want to help them recreate the Mandelverse?
No, Howieverse. I'm glad Lemire decided to go a different direction.
Anyway, I think it's this will be a kind of a cool image book to check out for anybody who kind of likes the macabre stuff.
Yeah, the aesthetic is very interesting.
Mm-hmm. The Radiant Black universe keeps expanding.
Yep.
The couple weeks ago there was Supermassive, which is like the sort of the crossover. And it brought in a couple characters.
And then last week was Rogue Sun.
Just in case people don't know, Radiant Black was Image's like sort of new superhero character, and I'm going to mention it just because I finally got around to reading a few issues of the original one and liked it quite a bit.
Yeah.
I understood that there was like a sort of a Power Rangers-esque inspiration, but it feels just as inspired by something like Invincible.
Yeah.
Although without the super violence, at least so far that I've seen, but with like a slight PG-13 edge, there's some swearing in it, and like it's got an interesting story about like a dude who's a kind of wannabe writer, but who's basically in huge financial debt and has to go live back with his parents again, but then finds this super suit sort of thing, and he and a buddy kind of go about trying to figure out what to do with it. So now that I've reading that and liked it, I'm kind of interested to see the expansions, because what I understand is this new one is the character who had been a villain in his own, in Radiant Black.
The one that comes out this week is Radiant Red.
Yep.
And she was like the bank robber in the early
days? Yeah, she was.
Yep. Yeah. And like, I guess, minor spoilers, but this is like, was not obviously a girl, was not obviously, I think she's young, right?
Yeah.
Middle school age?
No.
Not that young.
Oh, I thought
she's married.
Oh, okay. I thought that when I was making the sign for it, they said like she's trying to handle that. Maybe she's got a kid. I don't know. I'll look and see what it was. I probably I misread something. But anyway, I know that she was the antagonist in the first miniseries. So that sounds like a cool thing.
Yeah, she's a teacher. She's a middle school teacher.
Ah, that's what I saw. Got it.
So this is fun. Nick, you liked this one quite a bit, right?
Yeah, I like the character. In the first trade, they introduce her and sort of give her a kind of a slight backstory. Here we're getting to sort of see an expansion of that and why she became sort of what she became, and then sort of her turn back to, I guess, the good side.
Yeah. What it's not the same writer as Radiant Black, or it is?
No, it's not.
No.
Okay.
And same deal with last week's Rogue Sun, which I really liked.
Yeah, I need to get around to reading that one. That's like a supernatural New Orleans hero, right?
Yeah, he's a New Orleans hero. Seems to be
like a legacy of some sort.
Yeah, so it is a legacy story about the original character dies early on, and his son, who never knew he was a hero, winds up taking on the role over the objections of the son from his second marriage, who knew about the superhero thing and thought he was going to be the hero. So,
you know, I think none of us are like, boy, would we like to see them creating more superhero universes, right? But this is kind of an interesting way to do it.
Yeah.
They didn't sort of announce that it was their plans, but it's been sort of slowly being rolled out. Started with Radiant Black. That was a hit on its own merits, because it was supposed to be part of the first of a shared universe. And, it seems like they're putting out some good companion
books. Well, and it's not a huge shared universe.
Right.
It's going to be Rogue Sun is an ongoing. Radiant Red is a miniseries.
Okay.
Supermassive is a one-shot. And so really it's like one or two.
And then there's an OGN coming.
You know what? Yeah. That reminds me of the relative controlled size of the Black Hammer universe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is Dark Horse's thing from Jeff Lemire. And I think that's pretty cool. I wish them well on it. I'm gonna keep on checking out their stuff.
We got season two of Naomi, largely because it's a CW show.
Yep.
It's the original creators, David Walker, Brian Michael Bendis, and Jamal Campbell on art. If you like the original Naomi, there's more of it.
Yep.
DC starts the Trial of the Amazons, which is a little crossover between Wonder Woman,
Nubia and
Wonder Girl.
Yep.
The various tribes of the Amazons are sort of going to war. There's a lot of diplomatic stuff going on.
I think they are going to vie for either like. I know that, like, that gate that they guard that, like, is, like, sort of, at least in the Prez era, was, like, all the demons and monsters of Pandora's Box were held under Paradise Island, and that was sort of their job to guard it. I think some incident with that sparks, like, a new issue, and I think they may be vying for leadership of the Amazons.
Yeah.
So, essentially, you've got the three tribes, which are the, sort of, the, I guess, the classic Greek one. There's I think this is still the case, a Middle Eastern sort of offshoot.
Yeah.
And then there's the one that's, what, the South American? Is that the deal in the recent one?
Yara Flor.
Yeah. And that sounds pretty cool.
Yeah. There are a couple... So Devil's Reign had a few this week. Devil's Reign comes with penultimate issue, number 5, along with a one-shot featuring Moon Knight by Moon Knight writer Jed McKay, which I really liked.
That's a fun story that I read that one, too, where Moon Knight is in jail. And the kind of neat thing that sort of happens early on is, you know, like Daredevil and other heroes have been in jail before, and a lot of times there's, like, trying to avoid anybody. Like, I remember Daredevil's thing was, like, he's, like, needed to plausibly deny that he was Daredevil in it, but, like, occasionally, like, he would, like, somebody would corner him, like, in the shower or wherever, isolated, and he'd be able to reveal, like, kick their ass or whatever. Yeah. Well, Moon Knight is just like, yeah, I'm Moon Knight, and, like, when people mess with him, he gets in their face just as much as, you know, it was Warren Ellis who kind of came up with the, I wear this silver-white outfit because I want him to see me coming.
Yeah.
And this is a little bit of that same thing, even though he's just walking around plain clothes, he's like, I don't care if you know who I am.
Yeah.
And it calls on some older, more violent Moon Knight history in a kind of interesting way. And the story has kind of a neat little structure with some neat reveals at the end.
I would say if you're a Moon Knight fan, it's definitely worth picking up.
Yeah, for sure.
Also, Devil's Reign Superior 4, number 3, comes out this week. That's Otto's been pretty involved in Kingpin's plans, and that's why they've been doing the side story. The second part of the Nightwing Superman crossover comes out.
So good.
Superman Son of Kal, number 9. It was super great. Yeah. both those books are high up. They're probably my number 1 and my number 2 books right now. And there's some really fun stuff in there.
Yeah, just his interactions between them are really strong. And there's some neat stuff moving forward. Stuff having to do with Lois Lane. Stuff having to do with their friendship. And stuff having to do with Superman's past, that is to say, Jonathan Kent's past.
Yep. Joker gets its penultimate issue under James Tynion, and I guess there's one more to come.
It's like a 13-issue miniseries, 14-issue?
14 issues. This features Joker trying to tell he's been captured by this Dallas super-rich family of cannibals, and it features the Joker criticizing a cook and telling him how he should cook him.
Sure.
Which is pretty hilarious.
That is a pretty awesome Joker concept.
I feel like that's on brand.
Yeah. Amazing Spider-Man Beyond is moving towards its conclusion. This issue features a new version of the Lizard. He has wings now.
What?
So he's been modified by Beyond.
What?
And he's facing off with Peter Parker and the Daughters of the Dragon. And there's a reveal as to what character was fused with this Lizard to make him change. And they're definitely ramping toward the end of this Beyond storyline, which I've really been enjoying. Next, the finale of the God of Hammer story in Thor. Second issue of that New Masters, which I really liked. It's the Image...
It's...
Afrofuturism thing.
Yeah.
It was a good second issue. And then a few things from last week. There were two Star Trek books. One is a one-shot on focusing on the Klingons.
And for those who are... If you have any Klingon fandom in there, I believe it focuses on... is it Kalis? The legendary Klingon of legend.
Okay, he looks like Worf to me.
I mean, you know,
they all look like Worf to me.
Yeah,
I'm just saying.
I think it's the guy who's like the Achilles, of Klingons.
Yeah. Then there's a Star Trek Discovery: Adventures in the 32nd Century, which it takes them into the current, you know, far future that they're in, and it is all from the point of view of Grudge.
The
book's cat.
Yeah, his big old Maine Coon cat, which I actually did not plan to read this. I was like, well, that's just a little too silly. But Randy, you read it and said it was pretty good, and I know you're not particularly a cat person.
I'm not.
I am a cat person, and I read it, and I was like, you're right, Randy. This is actually super good.
It was super fun. Yeah,
it is, and I gave Nick a little bit of the highlight reel of some of this stuff, because it was so good I had to like say, oh, look at this panel.
It felt very cat.
Yeah, it's very cat.
Yeah, the cat, you actually literally get Grudge's internal monologue, which is written in kind of like normal English, but he's still kind of basically just, or she rather, does cat things, but it's all sort of lensed through cat perspective and makes, you know, uses a lot of this sort of humor we've know that people like about cats, you know, being like so incredibly like independent and aloof and all of that stuff, but tied into Star Trek. Has good, really good artwork, actually.
It does. It's really good.
A delightful last page.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, any number of moments that made me laugh out loud in it or were charming. I love the bit, Randy, where Burnham is, like, wants to... who hasn't gotten close to Grudge the cat before, is like, oh, come on, you've been so good. She's like, let me pet you. And the little narrative caption for Grudge is like, no. And she's like, just a little? And it's like, no. And she's like, ah, there it is. That's not so bad. And she's petting her, and Grudge is like, it's worse than I thought it would be.
Yep. Looks like these are going to be an anthology like next month. This focusing on Tall and Gray, the two the non-binary couple.
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool. I like all those characters.
Discovery actually has a pretty good supporting cast. Sometimes I think they're a little inorganic in how they use them.
Yeah.
But I like those characters.
Last week also brought us Loaded Bible, Blood of My Blood, in which a post-apocalyptic clone of Jesus fights vampires.
That's written by who? Somebody.
Tim Seeley.
Tim Seeley, yes. Yeah. Tim Seeley, you think he's a real kind of pious guy? You think he like had to do a lot of soul searching to decide if he should do something a little on the sacrilegious side?
Having read
like
his other stuff, no, I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
We got Dark Knights of Steel Gathering Storm, which reprints the first three issues. We have 1 and 3, but number 2 has been sold out. So
yeah, Dark Knights of Steel, I'm sure people know the basics, but it's like it's the D&D/Game of Thrones of DC Comics. It's by Tom Taylor, who, you know, broke out with alternate universe stuff like Deceased, Injustice. He's doing Dark Ages over at Marvel. I just wanted to mention his alternate worlds.
Oh, his alternate worlds.
And it's like that's such a niche he's really knows, and he's been doing really cool work on this. There's been like neat reveals in it.
Yeah.
Like you could just do a story where yes, it's just DC characters recast as fantasy stuff, and Green Arrow becomes Robin Hood or whatever.
But no, he's doing his own.
He's done
thing.
A much more thoughtful thing, which has lots of surprises in it, and you're like, oh, what is going to happen next with this? This is actually, it has some of the appeal of Game of Thrones.
Yeah, and we have all of it. So the Gathering Storm is 1 through 3, and then we've got 4 and 5. 5 just came out last week.
So you can get caught up, right?
You know we love Tom Taylor.
Yeah.
And this is really good. Jed McKay launched Strange last week, which has Clea, his longtime girlfriend and occasional wife, I believe.
That is Dr. Strange's...
Yep. Taking over as the new Sorcerer Supreme. Much to the chagrin of Doctor Doom, who thought he should have been.
Just to double check, Doctor Strange is dead.
He is
at the present.
Yep. Although Clea is trying to bring him back.
They've already acknowledged that he, like in a way, already did because she met with a younger version of him.
Yeah, that was all the Death of Doctor Strange miniseries.
I kind of like when they don't try and play around with the fact that somebody so powerful as Doctor Strange is a hard person to keep dead. Like, it's pretty obvious, and I think we would all know that he is going to return, but they're not trying to trick us, right? You know, like, oh, right. He's dead for good.
Yeah.
They're not trying to trick us. It's a straight-up plot point that she's trying to resurrect him. But the big thing about this issue, and I didn't, like, I flipped through it and I wasn't like, eh, I'm not feeling it. But when I read it, I actually quite liked it. Clea, she's been a supporting character, essentially Doctor Strange's girlfriend, since the 60s.
Yeah.
Right? But probably, I think few people would be able to say, I know a lot about Clea. I really like her character. And he finds a tone for her in this that I think is pretty cool. And part of it is that she is the, what, granddaughter of Dormammu, the freaking demon?
Yeah.
And
she's not human at all.
She's not human. She comes from another dimension, and it's like a dimension of, like, conquerors, right?
I believe so.
Right, Randy?
Yeah.
So she comes with attitude.
Yeah.
And the power to back it up. And it's pretty interesting to see what she does with that. There's also good interactions with Wong in it.
Yeah.
Like, the two of them talking together, that he's still kind of grieving for Doctor Strange. But, like, not just, like, there's a little bit of lightness in it, too. Like, Jed MacKay, that's kind of just how he writes. He's not, like, all doom and gloom.
Yeah.
And so there's some fun energy to it.
I also like the new location that they...
And she does face off with Dr. Doom, like Randy said.
Yeah. I also like the new location they brought up, the Shrouded Bazaar. I thought that was a fun idea.
What do they call it? A goblin fair?
Goblin market.
Goblin market, yeah. Anybody who knows kind of Fae legend stuff will have heard of that sort of stuff. And, yeah, this is the neat new sort of, like, what will probably be a recurring... place in this series, I think. And in Doctor Strange books to come, I would imagine.
There's also a great last page reveal bringing back a character that I was surprised to see.
Yep.
But that works.
Hang on, I'm flipping to it. I'm not going to say it, obviously, but I need to see and remind myself who it was.
There is a new miniseries that came out last week by Tom King.
Oh, right.
With David Marquez on art, called Batman Killing Time. Looks to be basically just sort of tie into the Batman movie in that it's got Batman, Riddler, Catwoman, and then weirdly Killer Croc and Penguin.
But I will say this, although I don't think... I know neither you nor I are Tom King fans, and I know Nick is a sometimes fan.
Yeah.
But that I don't... I would never guess accuse him of being a cash grab guy.
No.
So I think DC wanted that put out for that reason.
Yep.
But I'm sure he finds a story to tell in that, even if it ain't a story I want to read.
Yeah. It's very pretty.
But I do know that, like, he always works with good artists. A lot of people like him. So just if you're a Tom King fan, you should probably check out Batman Killing Time.
Yep. Just another Batman miniseries. Nice House on the Lake came out. The trade paperback came out. This is the James Tynion horror book. About, I don't want to say what it's about, actually.
Right, but a very shocking thing that happens when something of an oddball outcast type dude invites a group of friends / acquaintances
to his lake house.
To his very, very nice lake house. And there's already some weird stuff when they get there, but, like, it still seems like a normal outing, and then really something strange happens after that. It sets up the whole premise of the series. There's a reason why, like, people have been trying to snap up issues of this, and that it's a hot issue. Like, people, like, it's gone up in value. It's being produced as a, like, if they make it, there's going to be, like, a TV or a streaming series produced by, God, who's the guy?
Oh, Mike Flanagan.
Mike Flanagan,
right.
Who made Midnight Mass and, God, why can't I suddenly say the big one? Midnight Mass.
Dr. Sleep.
Right, but no, his Netflix miniseries.
Oh, Haunting of Hill House.
Haunting of Hill House. Yeah, everybody watch that. Anyway, it's going to be one of the big books, I think, for the next several years. And you can get the trade paperback right now and dive right into the comic.
It's just a 12-issue series.
Oh, is it?
Yeah,
cool.
It's just 12. So this is volume one, and they're starting on volume two the same week. So number seven came out this week.
Nice.
So you can jump right in. And we all really liked this
I book. Like a punchy and finite story.
It's also got fantastic artwork.
And the same goes for the thing I think you're about to talk about next.
Yep, so this is Scotty Young and Jorge Corona's The Me You Love in the Dark. This is a book about a... We've talked about this, the single issues, but the trade paperback is out. It's a done-in-one story.
There's a young woman who is a struggling painter. She's basically hitting that... what do you call it? when you create a writer's block for painting,
yeah.
Right? Artist block. Yeah. And but she's got some money from sales, and she ends up buying a decrepit house that has rumors of being haunted. And she's like, I actually think that's charming. I'm gonna move in here, and I'm gonna find my energy to paint again. And she sort of does, but in the sense that it truly is haunted, and she begins an ongoing sort of conversation and interaction with a strange entity.
Yep.
I don't want to say too much more than that, but what the ends up being actually very well written characterization of this thing and her interactions with it, and it also talks about creative process stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It is creepy. It has beautiful artwork and a good ending.
Yeah, it's a solid ending.
I don't know if it's something that they're going to pursue further. I think if it was always just this, that's fine. That's it's a very good standalone.
Yeah,
but yeah, I really liked it. In fact, it remains one of my favorite miniseries of roughly the last year.
And then a couple trades. Moon Knight has been kind of hard to come by, but they got two of his epic collections out. So you don't have the very first, but you have like the second and third.
Yeah.
There is the Charlie Houston. No, not the Charlie Houston stuff. The Bendis stuff.
Yep.
Where it was like weird, where he thought he was some of their superheroes.
Yep.
We got the volume one of Jed McKay's run, although that is out right now. We should get it back in next week.
And that's the one that I would probably maybe most recommend to people, other than the one you're about to mention. Jed McKay's is basically the current Moon Knight.
So this volume, I actually really like this. The one coming out this week is the stuff by Jeff Lemire and Greg Smallwood.
A few years back.
He starts off in like an insane asylum, and there's some question of whether or not Moon Knight's even real, and of course he is, but it's a... They're doing a lot with sort of the Egyptian motif and the, how much of this is all in his head. It's a really good Moon Knight run. There's 14 issues in this. It's just a complete run in here. Really, really good stuff. There's also the Marvelverse, which is their sort of all-ages smaller digest.
Is this one that usually reprints stuff?
Yeah. So it's got the first issue of Werewolf by Night that introduced him. It's got a number 13 of the Moon Knight series, which is like high point of the Doug Mensch and Bill Sienkiewicz stuff. It has a Amazing Spider-Man issue where he teams with Spider-Man, and it has a Cullen Bunn annual from 2019.
I sometimes love the weirdness of comics. The fact that Moon Knight's introduction was in Marvel's 1970s Werewolf comic.
Yep. Well, he was introduced as like a villain for Werewolf by Night, because that's the whole thing. He's Moon Knight. He's silver and all that stuff.
Right, a representation
and
of the...
He was a mercenary hired by this council that was hunting the werewolves. And then when they actually... I guess he worked well enough that they retooled him. They retooled his origin. And then they did a story. They're like, I pretended to let this council come up with the Moon Knight idea, even though I was already Moon Knight.
That's funny. Yeah, and that might be a little silly, but I sometimes like when they make stuff work with the continuity.
Yeah.
I appreciate a good faith effort to try and make even a weird previous version of a character work.
Yeah, yeah.
And arguably that is something that there was, like, honestly, the sort of violent Moon Knight of about, 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
I think none of us liked that version, but they do evoke that somewhat in this week's Devil's Reign Moon Knight, and they do a pretty good job of it. About as good as you could get, I guess I'd say.
This is also the week where Marvel's done some second printings. New printings of Silk and She-Hulk number 1, new printings of Thor number 21, new printings of Daredevil Without Fear number 1, and a new printing of Black Panther number 3, so... If you have missed some stuff, because stuff has been selling out a little quicker in these pandemic times, Marvel at least is starting to get a little bit more on the reprint bandwagon again.
Yeah, for some time now, it's been, you know, like, if you miss something, we have not usually, very, very often, not been able to get it very easily, which used to be one of our hallmarks, as we would reorder very aggressively. We still do as best we can, but it's just the pandemic has made that much more difficult. And so it's nice to see Marvel doing this. I hope this that trend continues. People should buy all the reprints so that Marvel will keep doing it.
Yes.
And also, by the way, She-Hulk, it was super good, and you should read that number one just because.
Yep, number two came out last week, and we still have that.
Get on board, yeah. Punk.
Right.
Sorry, I got a little aggressive there. Yeah.
A hard sell.
Yeah, if they're not going to pick it up, then I'm going to put them in their place.
All right, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk about some TV and some movies. So So we watched a few things in the past few weeks.
Yeah.
We're going to close out this week with the Batman spoiler review for me and Dave.
Yep.
But we'll give you a big spoiler warning when we get to that point, and we will. Nick's going to excuse himself because he hasn't seen it yet.
I think broadly speaking, I can say that we think that people should go see it,
yes.
Even if we weren't the biggest fans in the world of it.
Correct.
You should definitely go see it. It's clearly going over well with people.
Yep. But first, I want to talk about Cat Burglar, which is a cartoon on Netflix. You guys remember Bandersnatch, the Black Mirror thing that was like a
Choose Black Mirror episode? Yeah, where you like used your remote or whatever to essentially choose different options.
Yes. So Cat Burglar uses this similar technology. It's a Charlie Brooker thing. So he's the guy who does
Black Mirror.
But instead, it is a dead-on Tex Avery cartoon.
The whole thing is animated.
It's all animated. Tex Avery
being the 1930s and 40s, like, animation pioneer.
Warner Brothers cartoons.
Yeah, if you ever saw, funny. Like, the, also did, like, the little, like, Red Hot Riding Hood, the sexy Red Riding Hood and the wolf who howls for her and smashes things on his head.
This in particular is a Tom and Jerry Bugs Bunny type thing.
Got it.
So basically the pitch is that there's a cat who's a cat burglar.
Yep.
There's a droopy dog style security guard who is told, we have a priceless painting, keep it safe, and the cat burglar overhears and he tries to steal it, and the dog interferes with him.
Mm-hmm.
You are sort of following along with the cat burglar, and at various points it will begin asking you trivia questions. And the trivia question things like, it's like questions about Australia, it'll ask you four questions. And usually like three of them are super easy, and the last one's hard. If you get all of them right, it continues on and shows you a little thing and whatever. So, for example, there's one where the cat is like using a balancing pole on a high wire, and if you get it right, then he gets past the little thing and gets in there and goes to the next stage. If you get one of the questions wrong, he dies somehow.
Yeah,
and then he goes up to cat heaven.
Yep.
And then he says he has three lives, and he's like, you might be thinking nine lives. And that is a quick cut of, like, six lives that he has lost.
Uh-huh.
And so
he got down to traditional video game levels.
Yes. So as he goes through, he goes to, like, the Egyptian wing and the medieval wing, and then he goes and gets the painting, and you are in the old time, you get asked these questions, and you either get him through it, or he dies and finds another way to try to get in.
Uh-huh.
And... Yeah. If at some point, the first time he dies three times, he goes up to heaven, and God explains that he needs him to pull eyes.
Oh, God.
And the cat's like, why do you need me to steal this painting? He's like, I'm God, don't ask me any questions. And sends it back down, and then you start over. So you can watch this, and there's numerous, like, different ways.
Have you gotten to the end?
Yes, a couple times. Because when you get to the end, it's like, do you want to watch it again? You will get a different cartoon. So I watched it through a few times, and there's enough stuff. There's enough little bits. The dog. I mean,
you still see some of the same stuff.
Some, not a lot.
Really?
There's a fair amount of different. There's a point where after
I assume
about,
that they learned at least something from Bandersnatch, and which it had its own meta qualities, but was also like occasionally repetitive.
And I will say this has the same problems as I watched. After I watched it through about three times, I was like, okay, I'm starting to see stuff I already saw. I'm starting to skip through things to get to the next part. And I want there should be like once you go through it three times, there should be a just show me the other stuff.
Yeah.
I feel like they need that. That is the one innovation I would add to it. But that said,
you're like the person who wants to just go and watch all the clips of all the sex scenes of Mass Effect. Just say it, Randy.
Sure, that's what I want.
Yes. I know who you are.
But anyway, I thought this was super fun, and I would definitely recommend people give it a watch. It's pretty quick. Like it's just like a 2 or 3 minute
Where
cartoon.
Where is this to be found?
It's on Netflix.
Netflix, okay.
But yeah, I really enjoyed it. Nick, I know you just got West Side Story hit Disney Plus.
Yeah, it did.
So you have seen it, and Dave, you've not seen the new one yet?
Have not seen.
I saw it in the theater.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous in the theater, and I just rewatched it this weekend as well.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous movie. It's a really well-done movie.
It's really good.
It's one of those... I
mean, West Side Story is a classic, and redoing it is a bit of hubris, but Spielberg kind of earns it.
I remember we had this conversation when it came out, and I was like, I don't think you should really remake this movie. I mean, there for obvious reasons, you should. Because of
the brown face
yes. And that.
However, maybe one of the best ones is the basic premise of West Side Story is itself a remake.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a remake of Romeo and Juliet.
Exactly. But there was a lot to really enjoy from this remake. Everything from just the way Spielberg framed shots to the musical numbers, which I thought were really good. The dancing.
Let me ask you, this is a key question I've got.
Yep.
How is the dramatic tension of it? Do you feel caught up in the sweep of it? Do you feel the tension still?
When I was watching it, the person I was watching with was like, I just want... She was just like, I just want him to make a different decision here. she knows where it's going to end, but you want them to not make the decisions they're making.
Right. I agree with that. I mean, you definitely see where things are coming. I mean, if you've seen the original, you know. If you've seen Romeo and Juliet,
I haven't seen the original in a while, so
yeah,
I'm sure it's still
either.
Like the exact way things play
but
out.
The tweaks are good. Like Rita Moreno. So Doc is the guy who owns the soda shop where they all mm-hmm. hang out. In this one, it is his wife, Rita Moreno.
Yep.
And she is a great character addition.
I love the fact that they don't do subtitles for...
For the Spanish? No.
For the Spanish. No, I thought that was a fantastic idea.
They also change who gets a couple of the songs.
Yep.
Oh. And they change the location of a couple of the songs. Mm-hmm. The framing of Be Cool...
Yeah,
is really good, and the way that and where they do it is really interesting. And the same thing with There's a Place for Us.
Yeah.
There's a few little things like that. The different staging of I Like It Here in America.
Yes.
That's a fantastic set piece.
Yeah, that set piece had so much energy and color, and just, it was fantastic.
By the way, the two leads are both really good.
They are.
But I actually think that the show is almost stolen by Anita and Riff.
Yeah.
The guy playing Riff reminds me of John Mulaney, and it's weird.
It is.
But he's great.
I agree. I also like that Corey Stoll and...
Corey Stoll's fun, yeah. He's a detective.
Exactly. And Officer Kripke is a character actor that's shown up in random places.
Oh, this Officer Kripke, but it's also moved around a little bit to a different place.
Yeah, a little bit.
Is there anything, any critiques? Any critiques?
It's a little long.
It's a little long.
Okay.
Kaylee was very much like, this is a little too much.
Well, you ain't seen the new Batman yet.
It doesn't feel long, but it is a longer movie. It's, I don't know, I think it has some stuff to say about, like, gentrification and that kind of thing, which I think he managed to scoot things forward without changing the time frame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's interesting because the very tweaks that it seems to have done are the kind of tweaks that happen in Shakespeare plays and new productions or movies of them all the time. They'll change dialogue around who gets it. They'll shift the time frame of things. They'll edit it down slightly sometimes. So these are pretty traditional ways to...
I feel like remakes in general are just kind of okay. They're always just okay or just outright bad. I mean, like...
But this is a little bit weird because it's a remake that actually uses the script... And it's like there's a tradition of like there wasn't only one production ever of this. A million companies have put this on, schools and a million college theater departments. So there is a tradition of repeating plays. Like we're very used to it. We actually see that all the time.
My criticism is for the audience that didn't go see this thing because it did not. I mean, I guess it was the middle of the pandemic, but. This thing did not. It bombed, and it's too bad because it was phenomenal. It was one of my favorite things I saw.
If you have Disney Plus,
I know part of it was because one of the actors was considered problematic.
Well, he is more than a little problematic.
Yeah.
But as somebody else I know pointed out, it's like movies are more than just one person.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And sometimes it might be worth at least remembering that. Obviously anybody can make their own call on anything like that.
Right. Yeah.
But I am looking forward to checking it out. I want to see it.
It's great. And then Nick, you watch Fresh, which I forget who the creator is on. He worked on something else recently, right?
No, not that I know of. The director of this is Mimi Cave, who's made a couple of other small films. This stars Daisy Edgar Jones and Sebastian Stan.
It's Sebastian Stan, who Netflix lists hilariously as... is it Netflix or Hulu this is on?
This is on Hulu.
And so they list it as Pam and Tommy's Sebastian Stan.
Oh, I will say producing this... producing is Adam McKay.
Okay.
So I know it's not it's a red flag for you because you don't like Adam McKay. However... I would recommend this, and I'm not going to go too deep because I want people to be surprised by this because it is one of those ones that I'd heard some buzz on it. I heard a kind of person kind of give their view of it, and I was like, okay, that I usually agree with what they say. So I kind of just press play like I usually do. And it's about a woman sort of frustrated with like dating apps and randomly gives her phone number to a guy, Sebastian Stan, who she meets at a grocery store. And they kind of have this fun meet cute as they're buying vegetables.
Okay.
And it progresses from there to some very weird places. And it's very, very gory. It is kind of shocking at times, but I think it's very, very good. I liked the story it told. I liked the characters.
Sorry, I was looking at my phone. what's the name?
It's called Fresh.
Is it a horror movie?
It has sort of horror vibes.
Okay. What other vibes does it have? Drama, comedy?
What's comedy, dark comedy, and a little drama, but most of it's kind of like a dark satire comedy.
Gotcha.
With a little Get Out vibes.
Okay. That sounds interesting.
Yeah. It's
Where be this playing?
It is on Hulu.
Okay.
And Sebastian Stan is just really kind of making a name for himself lately.
Yeah.
Not only as...
He obviously owned it as Tommy Lee and...
His performance here is great.
Yeah. That's the thing that made me want to watch it. I saw that he was in it, and I'm liking him of late.
He will escape being typecast, clearly.
Yeah, yeah. I watched... I think I told you guys a little bit about this. It's called From...
Yeah, it's the Harold Perrineau show, right?
So, it is Harold Perrineau.
That sounds like a variety show starring Mercutio.
It is not a variety show starring Mercutio.
What about
a variety show starring... It's not Walt.
It's Walt's dad.
Michael.
Yeah. Yes. It is not. So, From is... Although it does have Lost vibes. Like, they definitely... it has a little bit of that Lost vibe to it. So, basically, this is an Epics show. The same people who did, like, Pennyworth.
Yeah.
And the first three episodes are free on Prime, and then you have to buy an Epix subscription. So I've seen the first two. But it's good enough that basically when it all drops, I will go ahead and get a month of Epix to watch it.
Yeah.
This is one of my favorite things I've seen this year so far.
Are they just going to put it on like HBO because that's where Pennyworth went?
I mean, it may eventually, but I think that's because of the DC connection.
I guess that's true.
So From is a it starts with Harold Perrineau is the sheriff of the small town. He's ringing this bell. Everybody has to get inside before dark.
Okay.
And then this little girl, since they're all putting these, like, talismans up. And this little girl is with her mom in the house, and she hears a woman talking to her from outside. And it's like, she's like, Grandma is talking to her. And her mom is like, that's not Grandma. And she opens the window, and there's this older woman there talking to her, and like, let me in. And she opens the window, and it turns into a monster and just kills them both.
Huh.
Nice.
And the revelation is that they live in this world of, like, there's these monsters that come out at night, and they can trick you into opening windows, that kind of thing. Then there is a family, a mom, dad, and a couple of kids, driving around an RV. They're bickering a little bit. It becomes clear that they lost their son, and that they've all had some psychological damage from that. And they roll through this town as they're having the memorial for the lost mom and kid, and everybody kind of freaks out a little bit, and then slowly but surely they realize as they're driving this RV, they are rolling through town over and over again. Like, it doesn't matter if they try to go to town, they come back through the town.
Yeah.
So they're sort of trapped there, and they get pulled into this thing of like these monsters and this weird. And they're like, they don't know what's going on, and that's where it goes. That's where it starts from.
Huh.
So it is all the mysteries of, like, what are the monsters? What is this town? What is the culture of these people? And it's really interesting. The first two episodes, there's a lot of sort of mysteries built up. It reminds you of the early days of Lost, where you're like, what the hell is going on? I like to hope people learn the lesson of Lost, which is don't spin out questions you don't have answers to.
Yeah. Right.
So I feel like there's a better structure to it. But just so far, they're answering questions and they're set up in a very smart and fun way.
Hmm.
It's creepy. It's really effective. I like all the characters. I would definitely recommend giving this a look if you have Prime.
Right on. I don't.
I do, but I will, like you, wait for the whole season to drop.
Dave, you want to talk about Cyrano?
Yeah, yeah. Over in the indie theater world of things is a pretty mainstream indie movie, actually. Based on a, I believe I've been told, an off-Broadway play from the last several years. But Cyrano de Bergerac, famous play from around 1900 about the dude with the big nose. It was who falls in love with a woman and inadvertently kind of, or depending on how it's seen, woos her through another person. He writes the letters, the handsome guy reads them, she falls for the handsome guy traditionally, and then he's, of course, heartbroken because, oops, he accidentally created, enabled his own rival, and also took her under false pretenses, like seduced her, essentially. And that is always the kind of heart of this drama. It was, I mainly really knew it through the movie Roxanne. Y'all have both seen Roxanne, yeah. Right? Steve Martin movie from mid or late 80s. That's super good comedy, very open reinterpretation of it. But that brings it, so let's cut ahead to the present. And I know there was a Gerard Depardieu serious version of it in the 90s. This is a version that is serious, but is also a musical. And it's a musical in a somewhat non-traditional way, where it's not ones where there's big musical numbers, but it is one where it's almost more like song conversations will occur between characters. And they're good songs. Like, I haven't paused to listen to them separately, but I think that they are probably pretty good songs. They are, not I think, they are. But the big thing, Peter Dinklage plays Cyrano, and rather than do the traditional nose thing, the thing that he feels makes him weak is his height, his diminished stature as a dwarf. But he's in love with the woman Roxanne. It is a period piece set in what would be kind of like a, I'm going to say it's not a fantasy version, but a heightened version of 1600 France. Yes, and he is a soldier. Who's actually, like, in charge of, like, a company of soldiers, and he, but he's also an intellectual. He writes poetry, he kind of thinks on an artistic level, and, there's a very fun scene in the beginning. The way I would describe it is, it would feel like, this is from the original play, Cyrano de Bergerac, it would feel like the act of a bully if it wasn't for the fact that he, pulls it off with such panache. There's a play going on with this very puffed up, like, it's the great player so-and-so, and this very kind of, you know, fancy-collared, clownish type guy comes out, and the audience is applauding, and he interrupts, and he's kind of like, boo, get off the stage. And the guy is like, what? And he's like, I'm going to save the audience from you, and I'm going to pay off their tickets so that they don't have to see you prance around and perform so awfully. He's drunk too, but he's charming, and this is a real tour de force for Peter Dinklage, because he is also the romantic hero in it too. It is not just he writes these things and you're like, oh, if only he were what his words are or whatever. He actually is the romantic hero, but there it has the traditional love triangle where there is a handsome young man. Played by some black actor who I don't know. What is his name? Christian's character, Kelvin Harrison. Is that? I don't know if that's anybody. Haley Bennett plays Roxanne.
I think he was in the movie It Comes at Night, and I think he showed up in Trial of Chicago 7, if I'm not mistaken.
He does a very good job, and if anybody who's seen Roxanne knows that the dude who's the hunk in it is kind of like a meathead dude in it. He's kind of like a dope. This guy is not. He's one of the soldiers in Cyrano's like legion or team or whatever you would call it, squad. But he's smart enough. He's just not like an academic. He's not a romantic. He doesn't write poetry. He could never put those words together. But he's not stupid. You're like, oh, I kind of want to root for this guy, too. He seems like a good person.
Yeah.
As the story goes on, there is the traditional love triangle, but there is also a guy who's trying to woo her, who's kind of a powerful guy who has stakes in the army and who can, like, send Cyrano's team off on a mission and endanger his romantic rivals, which is something that happens because he's like, oh, I don't want this guy in there. I'm going to go put them out in danger on the battlefield. He's a super asshole. I believe it's the guy played by Ben Mendelsohn who can do
That guy has been typecast as playing an asshole.
Yeah, although he played a asshole turned good as a Skrull in Captain Marvel.
That's how they get you.
Yep, he flipped it.
I liked him in The Outsider. Yeah, he wasn't 100% an asshole in that. He was very much kind of just average guy.
He has a sinister vibe that they like to use.
They get to use his sinister vibe in this one. Anyway, it is really good. It's, you know, it's sad and beautiful and it's moving and it's a good date movie. I feel like, again, for like kind of an indie movie, it's not that indie. Like, I feel it's no particularly more indie than, what do you call it, West Side Story was. It's a very approachable story with lots of funny stuff in it too. And some cool sword fights. He is like supposed to be a badass fighter. There's a scene early on where like, for kind of shaming that dude at the theater, some dudes try and jump him, and it's like 10 armed swordsmen attacking him on this big open stairway in like the plaza, and it is a cool fight. It is actually like a badass action scene.
If anyone's gonna have that on screen presence, I mean,
what's that?
I think if anyone's gonna have that on screen presence, I mean, Peter Dinklage is a fantastic actor.
Absolutely. Anyway. It gets the recommendation. I don't think it's perfect. I think it probably is a slightly long. I don't think it's like over 2 hours or anything.
It's not Batman long.
Not Batman long.
Not West Side Story long.
That's right. West Side Story is on the longer side. Yeah,
but it's shorter than Batman.
Yeah, definitely.
Everything is shorter than Batman.
Anyway, what else? Are we ready for Batman?
No, we are going to talk about Star Trek Picard.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So we have sent Nick off to Siberia.
Yes,
because he has not watched Picard yet this week, and we don't want to spoil Batman for him.
Right,
and we're going to give a spoiler warning before Batman. So we're going to talk about Picard now. Yes. This is your spoiler warning for if you've not watched Picard season 2. Dave and I may spoil some stuff.
Yes, in fact, we almost certainly will.
We definitely will.
Because yeah, there's some guest appearances and stuff in this. But first, you know, I wanted to quick say something I sort of liked about it in a way. It almost could have been a denouement for the first season.
That's what I was going to say.
There's a bit of catch-up in the first 20, 30 minutes of what everybody's doing. But it's fun, though. Like, I think it's pretty energetic.
It isn't. I had some gripes with this.
Do you think it should have been the denouement?
I think so, because here's the thing. It's been a while since I saw season 1.
Yep.
And at the very least, there's no, like, previously on Picard that I thought really caught us up very well.
You know, I don't know that I felt like it needed it.
Now, so many times did you watch each episode of Picard?
Once.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I know you do a podcast, so I thought maybe you'd watch it more through.
Nah, I make notes sometimes while I'm watching, but that's all. I don't rewatch anything, even the stuff I like.
I guess I'd forgotten a lot of it, and I could have used a quick recap before we jump back into the... Because a lot of this... A lot of this is predicated on the, oh, look, this guy's back at Starfleet, and he's a captain now. Look, this woman who is so disillusioned, she's back at Starfleet.
Right.
And I'm like... I got that, but then I got the recollection of like, oh right, she was mad. I'm like, if I'd had that in my head of like, oh yeah, she's mad at Starfleet, and then I saw her at Starfleet, I would have interacted with it differently. That makes sense.
I think the weird thing is I think almost somebody coming into it clean who had not seen season 1 would actually be better off because they wouldn't be having those questions. Yeah. They would just get there's a little bit of history going on here.
Yep.
Captain Rios, who had his own ship before, has given that ship to Seven of Nine to go do Fenris Ranger stuff. He himself has been given a super cool freaking ship, the new Stargazer, which is the update of Picard's old ship.
And it is a cool looking ship. And it's got Borg technology in it.
It's got Borg technology, which may or may not be relevant. Almost certainly will be relevant, actually, I guess, to come. Dr. Jurati, who had like had some mental implants in her that made her do some bad things in the season, is processing that, but is called back into action.
By drinking.
She's not called back into action by drinking, but she's processing by drinking. Yeah. I actually love that she's on the bridge and clearly drunk.
Yeah. Allison Pill's a delight.
She's very fun. You know, there's some distaste for the character, though, and I think it's the same as some of the distaste for Scarlet Witch, which is to say female characters who have been, done what would be kind of larger than life bad things in these fantasy sci-fi things.
Yeah.
They take more heat than guys tend to.
I agree.
And people were like, Allison Pill must die or Dr. Jurati must die. And I'm like, she was literally mind controlled.
Yep.
It was like a Vulcan mind meld kind of thing, something, or something that. But anyway, Picard himself is on his vineyard and seemingly going well. It's like wine. It's like picking grape season, wine season, whatever. It's the season to make the wine. And
it is the season to make the wine.
And you see when one of the Romulans who helps tend things for him,
yep,
that when she kind of has a moment late at night when they've both been drinking a little bit of almost romance, and he pulls away, and it sets up, I think, what's going to be one of the key themes in there, which is to say that he's never made time for romance in his life. And yep, we've never, you know, that's always, it's always been kind of the same thing that they would do with Kirk's kind of many changing women. They would say, oh, he lives for the job, he lives for the ship,
yeah,
and he has no time. But I believe what they're doing is integrating a bit of Patrick Stewart's own real history, which is to say, you see in flashbacks that his parents fought.
Yeah.
And I think this had been lightly alluded to before in, like, older Treks, but not much.
I feel like the post-Borg episode where he goes to live with his brother, they reference it. That's when they talked about
it. I think so. But I think they're going to make it more in the foreground. And I think... So Patrick Stewart has, like, written articles about this. Like, his father was an abuser.
Yeah.
He was abusive to his mother in a really terrible way. And so it's one of the causes that I think he champions is sort of preventing domestic abuse. And I don't know how much that'll play into it. We haven't quite seen it escalate to that. But I'm wondering if they're going to sort of make out that Picard, one of the reasons he has never been able to find time to have relationships, is he's fearful of becoming like what his father was.
Yeah.
To him, like, that is what a relationship is something that breaks down.
Yeah.
And I think that is an interesting and new take.
And well, because he's had romances. He's had lots of failed romances, like Vosh, I would love to see her show up in this, but
I would too. I don't think it's going to happen.
But him and Beverly had like a fling of sorts.
I don't know if it's, I think either the Romulan lady or Guinan, who's one of the big reveals later on, he goes to talk to her, says something like, I don't think you've ever been with somebody who you didn't think would be short-term.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of sort of biting lines like that. And at first he's kind of like, oh, you know, I'm not alone. He's like, I've got, you know, people I work with. I've got friends. I've got my, you know, I've got my work. And there was definitely this sense of loneliness to him, and I thought that some of that dialogue was pretty well handled.
I like him being an admiral and being like the new lead at the Starfleet Academy.
Yep,
that's a cool role for him. What's interesting is that they set up these roles, but because it's
pulled away from it.
Show, he always gets pulled away from it, and so it's like, oh, I kind of like the idea of Picard retiring and becoming running his vineyard, and then also being the head of the Starfleet Academy. That's a cool finale for him, but he's not ready for his finale yet because he's got a show.
Right. They'll probably, you know, maybe after the third season, which we know will be the final season, maybe they will return him to that or something. Yeah. But I did like that, you know, like Kirk famously, basically being promoted to an admiral from him as far back as Star Trek The Motion Picture, I think, was like a death sentence. Yeah. He's like, I want to be out there. There's movies had to keep finding any number of ways for him to get
bust him back down to captain.
And so if Picard can actually do this and like what he's doing and not become like an evil admiral like sometimes happens in Star Trek, or not hate it, that would be neat. Yeah. That would be good.
Yeah.
Anyway, but called back into duty he must be, because
there's a message for him.
There's a message for him that emanates from this rift in space that's just like, what, help us, Picard, or something like that?
Yep.
And when he... when he goes out there, it's like, becomes apparent it's the Borg.
Turns out, oops, it's the Borg.
Oops, it's the Borg.
And they claim, quite clear. They claim they want to be in Starfleet, or that's inferred, I think.
Yeah, and no, they said they want to join the Federation, or Federation.
But what's funny is Picard is like doing we should talk to them, and I think Seven is like, what are you doing? You got to blow them up. And so is Rios. I think everybody's like...
Seven is like, if you're wrong, then it's our ass. The ass of everybody. Like, they will wreck the Starfleet.
Yep.
And that is kind of what sort of happens.
It appears that he was wrong.
We know that there is something more to it, because basically their shields get penetrated and a Borg queen beams directly onto their bridge.
Yeah.
And starts taking over stuff. But in that time, security people rush her and stuff like that. And she starts, like, blasting them. But she's stunning him.
Yeah.
And so that is not very Borg-like behavior. There's clearly more to this story than we know right now.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think, what leads up to the sudden time flash?
Well, the ship gets blown up.
Does it get blown up?
Yeah, the self-destruct goes off.
Oh, right, yeah, yeah. Picard has to do the kind of classic thing which we've seen captains do before of setting it for self-destruct. This time, wisely, not like for 5 minutes from now, but for like 10 seconds from now.
Yep, yep.
But then he wakes up, and he's in his broken greenhouse, or I think it's a greenhouse, maybe, that we've seen in flashbacks that's part of his attached to the vineyard. Only he's dressed differently. There is a painting up on the wall of him wearing a sort of like almost like fascist sort of uniform, and then that's, I guess, what he's wearing. And then we get our other guest for it, which is to say the returning Q.
He ages himself up, which I thought was a nice.
Yeah, he's like, you look older than I thought. He's like, here, let me make you more comfortable, like very sarcastically.
Catch up,
yeah. And then, by the way, the brief appearance you see of the young version looks very good. And I think they wisely, though, like, literally it's only a few seconds, so you don't have time to notice any particular flaws before he ages to the present John Delancey age.
But it seems like he rescued him, but also he has done something to maybe make a sort of fascist federation. And the series to come seems to be that the Picard and his crew are going to, like, travel back to 21st century United States.
Yes, I believe the year is specifically 2024, so just a couple years into our future, maybe giving themselves a little bit of leeway to not have to probably hope that the pandemic wraps a bit.
Yeah.
But also, I don't know, it's not like the past of the fascist world. It should just be probably classic, probably meant to be our world. And that there is going to be some of that Star Trek fun of time traveling, like in Star Trek IV and any of many other occasions when Trek has gone back. Now, the interesting thing that people who have watched Deep Space Nine will know is that the mid, like, 2020s was also the time of the Bell Riots, where there was, like, massive income inequality and lots of pushback in there. And it's, man, it is one of the great episodes of Deep Space Nine is the one where Sisko goes back. And through time travel weirdness, finds out he was the one who started the Bell Riots.
Yeah.
Super good episode. And now that we're like, I'm like, this is a pretty good opportunity to also critique the world in our present.
I'm excited about the possibilities. I think my largest issue is that the opening, like the setup of like they blow up the ship and all this kind of stuff, it's a little big for me. I'm like, wait a minute. You did all this setup of like Elnor at the Academy and all that stuff, and then you're immediately going to an alternate world where none of that registered. That it felt weird to me.
I think the thing is like that will presumably the timeline will be reset.
Yeah.
It
felt a little bit like a cheat because I liked the status quo they set up. I like the status quo of Rios having a ship and Seven being out with the Rangers, and then all of that turns out to not matter to the overall story.
Well, so here's the thing. In the first season, they all had a reason to be working together.
Yeah.
And then at the very last episode, you see them on his ship together, and it's kind of like, what's next for us?
Yep.
And I was like, oh, they're going to be a crew. It doesn't quite make sense that they'd stay as a crew, but sure, whatever. And then in this one, I was pleased to see that they basically all went their separate ways.
Yeah.
Maybe they went off and had an adventure, and then they went their separate ways.
Yeah, but I guess...
So to me, like... The Borg thing is the threat that draws them together.
I get that.
And I think that there had to be some catalyst like that. Because there was no reason for them to be a starship crew together. To keep in touch? Sure. To be a crew? No.
I guess I felt like they spent so much time on it, and then Q's in the last, like, 5 minutes.
Yep.
That I felt like I watched an entire show of exposition for something that doesn't matter. I would have much preferred this to be the denouement of last season, and then for Q to start off in the middle of this.
I disagree. Yeah. I disagree because I think Q's presence in that last few minutes was like the shot in the arm you need to kind of like make us kind of excited to see what's next.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because I didn't feel like I certainly didn't feel like it was all exposition. Like to me, this was character building stuff. We were learning things about how the present state of these characters. And so that we know we know who they are as they go forward.
That makes sense. To me, I felt, maybe I'll feel differently if I rewatch it, but it felt to me like they were establishing the status quo for season two, and then I was like, oh, that wasn't the status quo. You were just telling me all that stuff.
Well, I mean, Captain Rios may not be captain anymore, but he is still that person. Also, here's the thing. Although they did here's a glimpse of some of the subsequent episodes, and a lot of it was time travel, I don't know how many the episodes are. 10 episodes? 12 episodes?
Yeah.
I actually don't know if there might be more stuff in the present. But, like, either. They may even, like, have some stories that recur concurrent, like, stuff, present-day stuff going on and past stuff. I don't kind of think so, because they didn't show that in the preview. But if they're holding out... Because, like, if they're going to, by the way, if they're going to talk about Picard's love life, I feel like I need to see that Beverly Crusher cameo. Or not just cameo. I'd like her to play a notable role the way Riker did in the first season.
Yeah.
And I can see them sitting on that, like, not showing it in the little trailer for the season because they don't want you to know too much. There was something, I forget what it was, like, if it was, like, the nature of the, exactly what the Borg were doing. But I'd like it if we actually had some concurrent story in what was the present at the time, which is, by the way, the first time that they have, like, spent any time in the 25th century now.
Yeah.
It is now, they've crossed the line, it's now the 25th century in Star Trek.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, I think I rated a little higher than you, but would you still say you had a pretty positive experience?
Oh, yeah, I enjoyed it. I just, there was a disconnect in that I was like, I felt I was playing catch up for most of the first episode, where I was like, wait a minute, who's that? Oh, right, that's this, and that was this. And
I think just because I have talked about it enough for the podcast, I had a most of it came back to me pretty quick.
I think that's what it is. It's like, for me, it went in and out.
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
You watch 800 shows.
I watch 800 shows.
Randy, one final thing. You and I, neither of us, I think, are the biggest fans of Q, but I ended up liking seeing him back. How about you?
Yeah, yeah.
I think John DeLancey, he played it just right. He wasn't too arch. He had that menace with a little bit of dry humor, I guess, I'd say.
He brings a certain energy that I think that needed, like you said, at that point.
He's a guy that Picard has never really beaten, per se. Yeah. He's always like, well, I guess I'm bored of you now, or whatever. All right, shall we move to the big one?
Yeah, so spoiler warning, if you have not seen The Batman yet, we're going to spoil things.
Yep.
And again, the quick pitch from me and Dave is, I don't think either of us particularly loved it. But we still think people should probably see it.
Yes, and I think a lot of you are going to love it.
Yeah. But in watching this, Dave, I think you and I both I came to this more hostile than you, because I'm pretty hostile to the DC movie universe.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had no intention of seeing it. And then a bunch of friends, like literally everyone I knew who'd seen it, said that they liked it.
It blew me away.
They're all like, they're talking about how good it was, and it was Batman as detective. And I'm like, okay, I guess I have enough interest, I want to go see it. And having seen it, I won't say I'm not unhappy that I went to see it, but I think my initial instinct of I don't need to see this was probably right.
Yeah, I'm kind of in a similar place. You and I are roughly in the same place, which is to say, like, there is a lot of craft to this movie.
It's well done.
And people are correct. It is a detective story. In fact, it is more than you probably think it is. It is like a procedural, essentially, with Batman working very closely with Gordon in a very, and I also feel like there's sort of true crime vibes, just in the sense that you kind of see, not quite in the Seven style, it's not that gory, but there is some intense scenes where you see sort of nasty stuff that the Riddler visits upon people, and there's a sense that crime in Gotham is pretty rough, and the whole thing is lit like Seven. By the way, every once in a while I did think, have these people never heard of light bulbs?
By the way, if you were watching Seven on one TV screen and playing the Arkham Knight games on another, you'd have a pretty close approximation.
Yes. just kind of squint and use.
Maybe play a Nine Inch Nails or a Nirvana album in the background.
I feel like the Arkham games are still bigger than this.
This got the aspect of Arkham of, like, he beats people. He beats multiple foes up.
Right,
he has the moves,
but he'll also take punches and stuff sometimes.
He gets hit by gunshot and that kind of thing.
For better or worse, I will say, like, that's the big scene where Batman fights all the dudes in Batman versus Superman.
Yeah,
that felt more Arkham to me than anything else.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, there's this scene where he takes down like about 10 dudes in a room, and or maybe more. And it has, like, a lot of those big crushing punches.
Yeah.
Here, it was a little bit more like the way Daredevil fights. He wasn't smashing people with his punches. He was dropping them to the ground.
Yeah.
But he was a little bit more vulnerable.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think you and I disagree a little bit on this, but I actually think this is a fantastic look for Batman. Like, I think he looked like Batman. I think Robert Pattinson's face, they molded a cape.
It's a thinner one. Like, they made it, like, so the headgear is a little less bulky, which I thought was a neat idea.
Whenever they put people in a Batman costume, they seem to, like... I mean, obviously they overdid it with Keaton because they didn't have the technology for it.
Yeah.
But, like, they always have these weird, they can't turn their head things. Like, the Christian Bale one is always looks very weird in it.
Or sometimes it makes I think the tightness of the headpiece makes their cheeks pooch out a little bit, and that looks a little silly.
Yeah, Pattinson looks like a Batman in this. I thought they did a good job of making him look like Batman. He doesn't look like Bruce Wayne. He looks like Fallout Boy.
he looks... he also... that particular Batman looks a little bit like... Gotham by Gaslight Batman.
Yeah.
His the particular collar and coat looked a little bit like that.
Yeah.
And even like the way he had, were those his little grapple things on his wrists? I actually wasn't 100% sure.
Or were they tasers? He used a taser at some point.
I thought he took that from one of the dudes.
Did he? Maybe he did. I don't know.
Anyway.
It was too dark.
It looked a little, his suit itself looks a little steampunky almost.
It does. No Man's Land look.
Yeah, survivalist sort of version. Yeah. So let's see what are some good things about it. They skipped the origin.
They did. Well, they not only that, they tweaked the origin. Like his dad was running for mayor,
right?
And they do a thing which I thought was very clever of basically like, why did his dad get killed? Well, it could have been this. It could have been this. It could have been this.
Right.
But they don't do a like the Joker killed your dad or. What I was getting afraid of that the Riddler was somehow involved.
Right.
I was starting to get worried, like, they were going to reveal the Riddler was, like, his orphan brother or something like that.
Yeah.
There was definitely some moments where I'm like, oh, don't do that. But the tweaks they made I thought were good. I do think they dirtied up Thomas Wayne more than I think they should have.
Yeah.
I was hoping for a reveal of, like, basically that Falcone was lying entirely.
Right.
There were a lot of places in this movie where I'm like, if you'd made a couple different, slightly different decisions... and added like 20% more light, I could have liked this movie more than I did.
Yeah.
And
chopped 1 hour off.
And chopped about an hour off.
One whole hour, because 3 hours is stupid.
Oh my God. So, that said, the actual overall arc of like the Riddler is like a serial killer who is targeting powerful people because of some big conspiracy.
Right.
It's a good... Again, I like the idea, but they made the Riddler this weird BTK killer type guy.
Yep.
And if they had just made him a classic sort of smarmy, smart Riddler...
Yeah.
I think you could have made... Because if you look at the... Again, you look at the Arkham City games, the Riddler in there, we never see him.
Yeah.
He just... He pops up to fuck with you, and it's always interesting.
And then you get an achievement after you've just solved 5 riddles.
Yeah, and by the time you get to him, you do want to punch him in the face real hard. I think that they could have done the same thing here without doing the he's a psycho killer person.
In Batman the Animated Series... He was a failed, like, software guy or something like that. And he had reason to hate well-off people in that one, too.
Yeah.
He was not exactly the blue-collar spokesperson, but he was a dude who, because of his envy, essentially hated the rich.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of the things he did in this could have still come out through some version of that.
I think a few more passes in the script and trying to make it a little more superhero-y would have helped. Because it is a crime thriller, and that's the thing they wanted to do.
Yeah, getting back to like a few of the things I liked though is like he is straight up working with Gordon in full view of the police department, and I kind of like status quo that's unquestioned. Where yes, a lot of people are not comfortable with him doing it, but they just kind of they do accept. It's like okay, Gordon has okayed it, so we're gonna kind of glare at him when he goes by, but we're gonna let him surveil the crime scene and all that stuff.
Gordon's bad friend.
Gordon's played by who's the good actor?
Jeffrey Wright. Yeah, he's fantastic. Actually, the cast sort of across the board here is really good. Pattinson is a really good Batman. I think, as always, their Bruce Wayne is a little thin.
Yeah.
The only person who actually brought anything to Bruce Wayne was Michael Keaton.
They also, by the way, went with the notion that, like, the Riddler says this thing we heard before sometimes, which is Batman is the true face.
Yeah. Andy Serkis plays a really good Alfred.
Yeah.
I thought Zoe Kravitz was fantastic as Catwoman.
Yep, she basically, her story sort of rather organically folds into it. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I liked their early working together. I thought that was some of the strongest chemistry between Batman and Catwoman, where they hadn't even had, like, really particularly romantic sparks early on, but they kind of were working close together, and sort of there was intimate vibes, and it was like, oh, that's pretty well handled.
Paul Dano plays a really interesting Riddler, I think. I think he plays him very well, even though I don't like that interpretation, but I thought he did a good job of what he was given.
The scenes where he confronts him, like, in prison or whatever, or in a holding cell, are pretty strong, I think.
John Turturro plays Carmine Falcone, and I thought did a great job with that role, sort of the smarmy, know-it-all crime lord. But the standout, the guy who almost steals the movie, I think, is Colin Farrell as the Penguin.
Right. Doing, I think basically Robert De Niro Penguin.
Oh, yeah, De Niro Penguin, for sure.
Rather than doing the Irishman CG version of De Niro, they just had somebody do a spot on imitation of him.
Yeah,
he's got a nasty scar on his face, but he's also kind of fun. He kind of brings some energy to it.
Yeah,
he's in the big chase scene. Speaking of sort of stuff that gives it energy, which I think it does need, and if somehow needed more at it 3 hours running time.
Yeah.
Michael Giacchino does the score to it.
Score's fantastic.
And he found a kind of a new sound that has this almost kind of like relentless quality when Batman is on the screen. That's his theme, which weirdly mixed in with the occasional reorchestration of Ave Maria, the spiritual song.
They tweaked Catwoman's origin in a way that I thought worked.
Yeah. Yeah, she's still kind of sort of a struggling to survive kind of person. It actually has something in common with Batman Year One without overtly making her a prostitute.
Yeah, I'll say this also. I think that there's a trick with the Catwoman Batman relationship where neither one of them can get fully punked out.
Right.
Like, Batman has to be, he can't be someone like she's constantly getting one over on him. But also, she can't be under his thumb. And when they first started, I'm like, she feels a little bit under his thumb.
Yeah.
And then they sort of revealed, like, oh, she's playing him to some extent, but not, like, too much of an extent. But that does tie into my biggest complaint about the movie, I think, other than the long run time and the lack of lighting, which is Batman sucks at his job.
Yeah, it goes to the, I know that Long Halloween is a beloved graphic novel, but I always was kind of annoyed that Batman basically just kind of fails from one month to the next, going from one crime scene to the next. Yes, gathering clues. Yes, doing detective work. But, like, never seeming to apply it in such a way that I'm like, oh, he saved people.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh, after a whole year of failing, you finally got the guy, I think.
Yeah, that's the thing is, like, they do him, like people getting killed. I understand, we're not supposed to feel that bad for the corrupt, like, DA and all that. But then the DA, the guy who plays him, I forget who it is, it's a notable actor, but he makes him sympathetic. You're like, I kind of feel bad for this doofus. Like, he's too stupid to know what danger he's in.
Right.
But, like, we're not supposed to care that this corrupt police chief, the corrupt mayor, whoever gets killed, but I am still like, he does kind of fail. And then at the end, the big reveal of the, like...
Also, like, some of those people have families that you are... that they make a point of. Yeah.
But the big reveal of, like, the water explode, like, his big, big plot, which he's going to flood Gotham away, it happens.
Right.
And, like, so Batman saves a few hundred people at the end, but he couldn't stop the he was too dumb to figure out what the Riddler was doing.
This is where I gotta, like, champion the Nolan movies, because, like, Ra's al Ghul had big plans, which, like, kind of started to go into effect, but did get shut down by him.
Okay, but yes, but the Riddler's plan was to blow up the seawall and flood the city, which is a Batman thing. The Ra's al Ghul's plan was to aerosolize some kind of weird fear gas that he put in. It's got a dumb plot.
It's vaguely made up of stuff that's, like, I think more like on the bleeding edge of military tech. But yes, it's like kind of a goofy plot. But I'm talking about the broad, so like, that goofy plots happen all the time in comics, and we forgive them if we like the beats of them.
Yeah.
I like the beats of Batman Begins, which is to say, there is this kind of heroic vibe of him sort of winning back the city. There's literally a scene of, like, a little kid he saves, like, smiling up at Batman in it.
I guess. I don't like the Nolan movies. I rank this higher than all the Nolan movies.
Right. But we have to remember that Randy is a weirdo who doesn't like the Nolan
movies. I'm a weirdo who does not like... I mean, I literally do not like Batman Begins. I've tried multiple times to watch it. And Dark Knight, while I enjoy it, I don't feel it's a very good Batman movie. This, I felt, was a better Batman movie. But it's still not what I want from Batman.
The Nolan stuff was closer to what I wanted from Batman. I feel like the tone was right. Like, the interaction with Alfred was right. Was better. The Batman kind of actually being a kind of enjoying the job and getting to smile sometimes in the Nolan's thing was all good to me. I'm planning to revisit them and see how I like them, because I'm not a huge fan of them, but I like them. I'm gonna see in the wake of the new Batman. Was it Matt Reeves. How the Nolan stuff stacks up for me. But anything else to say about it?
I'm trying to think if there's anything else notable. I think he didn't use a lot of technology. I mean,
the stuff with the contacts and stuff like that.
Yeah, that was interesting.
All of the stuff looked sort of like grungy, like Darkman's hideout.
Yeah.
There was a pretty good aesthetic to his, like, tech, where it looked a little stylized, but still also looked like... I don't know, almost the equivalent of some cobbled together college students tech.
Yeah.
The Batcave is not like a big presentation that to like, oh, there'll be a toy of this tomorrow. It looked kind of like a weird warehouse with also kind of a cave and stuff like that. And the Batmobile looked dope.
Yep.
I actually thought it was, the chase scene was well handled, but since they had shown that thing where he like knocks the Penguin's car over in the trailers,
I wish they hadn't shown that in the trailer.
I was like, oh, that was, you kind of showed the coolest moment of it.
Yeah, they that was a waste to put that in the trailers.
I agree.
Actually, the trailers are their own separate crime. I think the trailers, to some extent, they sold what this movie is, but I think for the most part, they didn't present the movie as it was. I think they were trying to.
They did that thing where they didn't really show much conversation from it.
Yeah.
Like, you could have actually shown, like, Batman and Gordon. They frequently are just, like, standing around crime scenes talking about details.
Yeah, I feel like they gave away stuff they shouldn't have, and they did not promote the movie well. I think they were bad trailers.
Do you think they were bad for you or bad for everyone? Because I think that most people are probably going to be a lot of people have been hyped for this movie.
I guess, but I feel like the trailers, and I know the early trailers people didn't like. I think that they promised a movie that it didn't quite deliver.
Interesting.
I really do feel like they played up some stuff that is not as heavily in the movies as it was in the trailers. Like, if this is a movie the trailers promised, I would have hated it, and I didn't hate it. Despite what
it looked a little, it played a little less serial killery than the trailers looked.
Yeah,
although there is that aspect of it, it does feel a little like Seven at times.
Dave, do you think that they're set up to do No Man's Land in the next movie? Because they definitely set up that's kind of that status quo. It's like the city's been
partially flooded.
They could like decide to cut it off and do the No Man's Land thing.
I suppose so. I think it'd probably be so different that it would feel only slightly like No Man's Land. Yeah. Also, No Man's Land, part of what makes it fun is like seeing established characters like the Penguin and how they survive in it.
Yeah.
Like, oh, what did Poison Ivy do? She took over the the park.
Yeah.
And Croc is off doing this and all that, and like, well, we only know one or two criminals at this point.
Yeah.
I heard there was some Arkham series that he wanted to do that he described as almost like a horror thing.
Oh, that was interesting. The decision to make Martha in Arkham.
Oh, right.
I don't know if I like it
from
or not.
From the Arkham family.
It was an interesting choice to basically like the Arkhams and the Waynes and the family and hers. Theirs was sort of like a royal marriage almost.
Right.
And that she maybe like had institutional problems and that kind of thing, which actually ties into the very way she is written in Flashpoint, where Thomas Wayne becomes Batman, a more brutal Batman, and Martha Wayne becomes the Joker, and it's all tied into like losing Bruce.
Right.
But it's that's an interesting little thing, I thought.
Yeah, there were lots of little interesting moments like that. Like I found many bits and pieces interesting.
Yeah.
But I didn't find it, I think, as compelling as the movie wanted me to.
Yeah, that's true. I will say, for being a three-hour movie, it never lost my interest. I wasn't really checking my watch or anything. I think I was...
I did start to do some planning of an RPG in my head. there were times I was feeling it.
I think for me, I was enough into it that I was like, I want to see where they're going with this. But then what I would hit was the thing of like, oh, I wish I would do the I wouldn't have done that kind of stuff.
Right. I'll be curious to hear what people think of it.
Yeah.
I think it's going to go over well, although the interesting thing that we talked about this, we had a pretty full theater we saw it with, but there wasn't any of the it didn't prompt and it wasn't the kind of movie that would any of the kind of enthusiasm that like Spider-Man did when we saw that, the last Spider-Man movie. No applause, no cheering.
Yeah, there's no big moments.
And yeah, like the closest would probably be the car chase.
Yeah.
And even that was kind of subdued in a way.
Yeah.
It's not going to provide those kind of that level sort of Marvel energy, but people may like it for being different.
I think DC is aiming for what they got with like the Joker movie. They want to do the award-winning superhero movies.
Right.
Which
sometimes, really, only I think the Batman ones are the prestige ones for them.
I'm just not sure why they're aiming that direction. I feel like there's no reason not to do a Batman that's approachable as Iron Man.
DC has always had, I think, a little bit of an insecurity that they are perceived as, like, at least the common thing used to be they were perceived as more kiddie than Marvel. You know, it's like, oh, they're a bunch of square-jawed dudes in the Justice League. Marvel's got the more realistic heroes. And then along come the 80s and stuff like that, and Alan Moore and Frank Miller and various other things kind of reinvent them, and they're like, DC can be gritty too, and not only that, we can be grittier than you, Marvel.
Yeah.
So I think they've always had self-esteem issues about that, and have always pushed back against it. And I think Batman is the main tool that they use to do it.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. All right. Well, that's.
Let us know what you think if you survive the 3-hour freezing process.
Well, that's all for that's it for us this week. And until next time,
yo
Cho.
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.